This is Law and Disorder.
This week on Law and Disorder, we'll be talking with an attorney from Amnesty International.
That attorney is going to tell us about the Amnesty International report accusing the Bush administration of serious violations of international law, torture, detention, and what it is doing to people around the world. What's the Bush administration response? Lie, lie, lie.
We'll also find out how the life and career of a valued physician was destroyed.
We're talking here about the plague. Hear what this government does to scientists. It's going on in Texas. It's going on in New York. It's going on around the country.
An animal rights activist will talk to us about how the government targets those groups.
Making animal rights people into terrorists, accusing them of crime. That seems to again be what we're doing after 9/11. Protecting the medical testing industry, protecting the food industry, protecting cruelty to animals.
We'll also be joined by David Reynolds, professor and author of a recent book on John Brown.
This book by David Reynolds, John Brown Abolitionist, is extraordinary. It finally puts John Brown in the place he belongs, the man who basically ended slavery. Welcome to Law and Disorder. I'm Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild. Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
Most of you have probably never heard of Yersinia pestis. Neither had I until I heard the story of Dr. Thomas Butler. Today we're going to talk about what happened to Dr. Butler. What happened is that Yersinia pestis is also known as the plague. Today we're going to talk to Robert Jensen, a journalist in Texas, and to Lynn Stewart, because this story is one that should put fear in all our hearts.
We have Robert Jensen on the air from Texas. He's a reporter for the Texas Observer. Welcome to Law and Disorder. We wanted to ask you, from your observation post down there in Texas, some of the details on this amazing story where Dr. Thomas Butler is sentenced to serve 2 years in prison. Can you tell us who the doctor is and how he wound up being on the other side of the bars?
Yeah, Thomas Butler was no longer a doctor and no longer a professor at Texas Tech, but that's where he was in January of 2003, a very well-respected researcher. He was an expert on bubonic plague and had done some very important work in his career. He's about 62 years old at this point. And it's really a chilling tale in many ways. What happened is Dr. Butler came to his lab, discovered that 30 vials of plague were missing. And after searching and being unable to account for them, did what one would hope, which is that he called university officials and then eventually the FBI was called in. What happened next, I think, is really very much a post-9/11 story. That is, you combine concentrated state power with a kind of almost hysteria that's in the air. What it ends up with is Thomas Butler convicted in a very strange process and serving 2 years in prison. How we get from that first call he made to his time in prison is in many ways just kind of a cautionary tale of what happens when power goes off the rails.
So what actually happened?
Well, much of this is from his defense attorney, corroborated by others in the field, but apparently what happened is the FBI offered Butler a deal. They said, listen, if you'll just acknowledge in a sworn statement that you accidentally destroyed these vials, then you can walk away. Now, Butler didn't really want to do that because he didn't feel like he had accidentally destroyed them. But
they were just missing, is that it?
Yeah, the vials were missing. No one knew at that point what had happened to them. And remember, this is a lab with a lot of equipment, and as I understand it from scientists, you know, missing vials are not exactly unusual. They might have been accidentally sterilized at the end of the day. Who knows? The fact is we don't know, and we probably won't know. But what the FBI did, apparently, is offer Butler a deal. Sign this statement. We can close the case. You can go home. He signed the statement, now, of course, against his better judgment. But instead of going home, he was handcuffed and led away.
Didn't they keep him up and question him?
Yep.
And deny him food and sleep for a long period of time?
Again, his defense attorney claims, it's a very consistent story, and it's easy to believe that this might be the case, especially when we look at the performance of the FBI, you know, historically and especially since 9/11. But the claim is that this was all coerced. They kept him up for 24 hours, and that he was really railroaded. Now, of course, the obvious question would be, why would they want to railroad Thomas Butler? Obviously, after 9/11, especially after the anthrax debacle, in which none of the law enforcement agencies in the United States were ever able to solve the anthrax mystery, you can see why officials want to both project to the public a sense of being in control and also to sort of just close a case. The FBI, through enormous manpower, they had something like 60 agents descending on Lubbock, Texas. And if you've been to Lubbock, and I'm guessing that most of you haven't.
The agents outnumbered the population.
Well, Lubbock, I think, is about 200,000 people. So 60 FBI agents in Lubbock could probably find most anything they wanted to. So there are questions about how this case was handled. What gets even stranger is that in addition to this charge of mishandling the plague virus, they also heaped on a bunch of charges that were, quite frankly, pretty trivial charges about fraud and mismanagement of grant money and various kinds of things that are really internal to university. I work at the University of Texas at Austin, which is a huge university, one of the three biggest in the country. And there's a lot of money, grant money, that flows in and out of this place. There's a lot of rules. Sometimes the rules get followed to the letter. Sometimes they don't. But what it looks like happened, at least from my point of view, external to all this, is that the federal government really just piled on every charge. Now, you all are lawyers. You know what, you know, count stacking is all about. It's to intimidate defendants. It's to try and maximize the position of the government to cut a deal. So they were charging this guy with things that really were kind of internal to university accounting. And it's very suspect from the moment this investigation began to the way the prosecution went. I think there's lots of reasons to be suspect, and we're not alone in this. Several Nobel Prize winners have actually come out and sort of sounded the alarm about this case and suggesting that it's going to be very scary for scientists, especially scientists dealing with bioterrorism kinds of issues, to go forward when you have, in this case, you know, a respected scientist who is apparently railroaded like this.
So did he have a trial, actually, or did he plead guilty, or what happened?
No, he did go to trial. He wouldn't plead guilty because, in the end, he said, I'm not guilty of anything.
Amazing. There were 15 counts. He faced 74 years in prison and $3.5 million fine if convicted on all.
Yeah, and he had been, I think, a lieutenant colonel in the Navy.
He had been in Vietnam. I don't know what branch of the service, but he was a veteran. He was, as I said, a very well-respected researcher and in this specific issue about plague. But, of course, once he was tagged with this sort of doctor terrorist, bioterrorist label, it was very easy for the government to pursue this. Now, there were 69 charges. I think he was ended up being acquitted on 47 of them, including the main charges about mishandling plague.
Really? Huh.
And they got him. What they ended up was convicting him on a variety of, you know, really quite petty fraud charges, as I said, that you know, really are kind of internal contractual disputes that universities deal with every day. Now, there are some who would theorize that what really happened is Texas Tech, the university, which, of course, like any major university, has a lot of government contracts, really decided to play ball with the government. This is speculation, and I certainly don't know enough to say this, but there are people who look at this and say, it looks like the university decided to give up one of its own just to play ball with the government.
Amazing. Just amazing. Mm.
Well, I want to read something very quickly that U.S. Attorney Boyle said about this. He said, an incident that could have sparked widespread panic of bioterrorism threat in West Texas was stopped clean in its tracks thanks to the quick, coordinated actions of federal, state, and local law enforcement. This case is an excellent example of how, in the present climate, authorities at all levels of government are approaching their commitment to protect the public with cool heads and join hearts.
Now, you know what it reminds me of? It reminds me of the pretext stuff they're using throughout the country, particularly against Muslims, of course, when they pick them up on immigration charges, you know, minor stuff, not reporting for work, or a variety of things like that, as a way of really just cowing an entire population or using terrorism, really, as that kind of a threat. It's just typical of what they're doing now across the country, unfortunately.
And I think that's why this case is so important, because, you know, most of us can look and say, well, you know, we don't handle plague virus, plague samples. What does this have to do with us? This must be, you know, the government must be right, because after all, you know, we should all be scared of this. It's so easy to sort of ignore this, but I think you're right. It's indicative of what happens in a climate of hysteria around a national emergency, as we've seen since 9/11, just how state power can be abused. And the problem is, of course, there's so little oversight. And, this man in his 60s, he's the father, I think, of four or five children. His career is over. He's surrendered his medical license. He's not going to be able to contribute to science. And he was, as I said, a researcher with a very distinguished career. So down the tubes, and for what? Well, maybe so that a U.S. attorney can offer the press release that we just heard read and portray the government as acting decisively to roll back these threats. This wouldn't be the first time in the U.S. or the first time, in our history around the world where governments play the game this way.
Yeah, that's for sure. I think it started in the U.S. with the Salem witch hunts in the 1600s. Robert Jensen, from Texas, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
Great to be with you.
Thank you, Robert.
Thank you.
See you again.
Okay.
And Michael Ratner, as you know, this case has got some scary parallels with the way they railroaded and framed up Lynn Stewart. We're going to go to Lynn Stewart and ask her thoughts. Lynn, we want to thank you for calling to our attention this amazing story about Dr. Thomas Butler, who's now doing 2 years in a federal prison, really railroaded in a kind of a fear campaign that has all kinds of parallels to what the government is doing to you. And we wanted to talk to you about that. One thing I noticed was that they stacked all kinds of counts against Butler, and they actually wound up convicting him of some trivial charges having to do with money handling at the university where he was a professor. And I know they stacked counts against you, too, didn't they?
They did indeed. And the most striking parallel is the major charge for which he was convicted was lying to the government,
yeah.
which I have made light of, considering how often the government lies to us. But nonetheless, you know, this is another darling of the prosecution and one they can get a lot of people on. But, you know, Dr. Butler, when I first read about him, what struck me as being so much a parallel was he's a man who worked his entire career to aid poor, indigent, poverty-stricken persons in Africa in particular, save thousands and thousands of lives by his research, and then to have the government turn on him in this way and accuse him of crimes to parlay some mislaid vials into a crime of bioterrorism. This is also a parallel. To make a press release, which is what I did, into a crime of aiding the terrorists. This seems to be their specialty.
Well, they use fear. They kind of manipulate it the way they did against the doctor and the way they did against you. And as you say, he was one of the top research scientists in the country with the plague, just like you yourself were considered one of the top lawyers in defense of poor persons in New York City. I think that what they did to you, tell me whether you agree or not, what they did to you was a way of intimidating lawyers, just the way I think they're intimidating research doctors by putting Dr. Butler away for 2 years.
absolutely right. And I think, in a sense, maybe in his case, I don't want to be too self-effacing here, but even more pernicious, because what it does is it attacks the entire academic community. It goes to the heart of whether or not a university will defend one of its own when big contracts for big money for research are at stake. Notwithstanding the irony that Texas Tech would never have gotten these contracts except for the fact that Butler was on their staff.
This case, your case, but this case even more in a certain way, because your case at least got some national attention. This case, and there's probably scores around the country, cases like this, that the government is just putting people away and no one knows about it. There's an air, really, I mean, Michael used the word McCarthyism before, but it's actually just a real police state repression going on.
Absolutely. You know, I got a letter in the mail today from a young woman up in Syracuse about Dr. Dafir, who was convicted the same day I was for materially aiding terrorism because this good doctor sent blankets and medicine to Iraqi children before the war.
Yeah, it's really insane. Dr. Butler, now they've taken him off the scene, and here is a person whose contributions could really have helped us in fighting disease, or your contributions in defending the Bill of Rights.
Well, I'd like to think so, Michael, but I really do feel that the sense of outrage expressed by his colleagues is very important in building a struggle like this, and I'm convinced by the letters that have been flowing in my case that the outrage of my colleagues against what has happened to me and understanding that this is a warning to all lawyers who defend against government, that the government will start calling the shots and you better obey them.
Absolutely. Lynn Stewart, thank you very much. Before we say goodbye, give us your website, please.
Very simple. Lynn, L-Y-N-N-E, Stewart, S-T-E-W-A-R-T, .org.
Thanks, Lynn, and good luck to you.
Thank you, Lynn.
Good luck.
Thanks
to all of you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
We've been speaking with Robert Jensen, reporter down in Texas, and with our own Lynn Stewart here in New York about the case of Thomas Butler. It's going to become, I think, once it becomes better known, really an example of what's going on in this country. The FBI and the government used fear. They stacked a bunch of counts against the guy. They wound up convicting him and sentenced him to 2 years in prison. They took away his medical license. They've been manipulating a climate of fear, and they took a distinguished medical researcher, just like they took Lynn Stewart, a distinguished defense attorney, and they intimidated the academic and scientific community down in Texas and from there nationally, just the way they intimidated the New York and national criminal bar by framing up and convicting Lynn Stewart. It's a cautionary tale. Dr. Thomas Butler, and you heard it first on Law and Disorder.
Just over a week ago, the New York Times ran an editorial about a draft document from the Department of Homeland Security, listing as domestic threats several groups, including the Animal Liberation Front and the Earth Liberation Front. The list failed to include anti-abortion extremists and white supremacist groups, groups which, as the Times put it, have a proven appetite for murderous violence. Joining us today to talk about the government's targeting of animal and earth liberation groups is Jerry Vlasic, MD, a board-certified surgeon and spokesperson for the North American Animal Liberation Press Office. He debates the scientific invalidity of animal experimentation around the world and has written on the subject. The press office was founded to communicate the actions, strategies, and philosophy of the animal liberation movement to the media and to the general public. Welcome to Law and Disorder, Jerry.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
Before we talk about how the government targets animal and earth activist groups, I'd like to talk a little bit about the Shack 7 trial, which began last Wednesday, June 1st, in Trenton. Can you tell our viewers a little bit about that?
Yeah, the SHAC 7 are seven activists with an organization called SHAC, which is an abbreviation for Stop Huntington Animal Cruelty, an organization that was founded to combat animal testing laboratory called Huntington Life Sciences, which is the largest animal contracting laboratory in Europe. So these activists have campaigned mercilessly around the world. There are chapters in some 16 or 18 different countries, and their tactics at times have been controversial. They've targeted not just the company that kills all of these animals, but the organizations that deal with the company. So in other words, the insurance providers for the company, the people who pick up their garbage, the people who transport various animals back and forth. So they've gone after not just the company, but those who make the company's day-to-day operations possible. And in doing so, they've been extremely effective. Before concentrating on this particular company, they went after and closed down, by making them financially unable to exist, four other animal breeding facilities. And so their tactics have shown to be extremely effective, and because of this, they're being targeted here in this country by the federal government, and they've been indicted under federal charges for basically animal enterprise terrorism.
Now, was this to do with the contents of their website in part?
Well, the website essentially, again, SHAC is a 501c3 nonprofit organization that's completely above ground. They don't do anything illegal, but they do report on their websites actions that are illegal that have been committed by other groups in support of their particular campaign. What we've seen recently is an organizing of animal rights activists, so that those working both above ground and underground have sort of combined their efforts instead of doing, you know, willy-nilly actions that aren't particularly coordinated. We've seen the underground, such as the Animal Liberation Front, come in to support various above-ground campaigns. And so what SHAC has done is they have just reported on these events on their website and said, well, yeah, you know, we've been protesting this guy or we've been protesting this company, but, oh, yeah, by the way, during the night, a bunch of people came in and poured paint stripper all over their cars. And they're basically, the government is then trying to say that they're inciting this type of action by reporting it
on the website. Now, they face some serious charges, like 23 years in jail each and over $1 million in fines.
Well, exactly. And again, this just shows that when you become effective and when you start to threaten the profits of corporate America, that you can expect to be cracked down upon by not only those companies in civil litigation, which they have also endured, but also by the government itself using new and invented criminal charges.
Well, they're really cracking down on these people's First Amendment rights, aren't they, to speak out about what's happening?
I think these people are, you know, having their rights threatened, and I think this is going to have huge implications, not just in the animal rights and the environmental rights movement, but it's going to have a huge impact, you know, in all progressive social movements.
Well, how do they tie this into their war, which I believe is a manipulated war against terrorism, manipulated fear? How do they tie it into that?
Well, somehow they managed to create in the public persona at least this impression that animal rights activists are terrorists. In reality, you know, what we call animal liberationists are defending innocent beings who can't defend themselves. The animal liberationists, those involved in the struggle for animal liberation, don't feel like our struggle is any different than these other struggles around the world.
Well, in Great Britain, for example, they have a more progressive attitude about animal rights.
Well, they do and they don't. You know, that we look to Great Britain is where a lot of the animal activism has sort of started and come from, and where they certainly have the most effective animal rights campaigners. On the other hand, they have much more draconian laws there against free speech. For instance, my wife and I have both been banned by the Home Secretary from traveling to the UK because we have been speaking out in behalf of animals, and because the pharmaceutical industries met with Tony Blair and asked him to shut down the animal rights campaign. And so I received a letter a couple months later saying that I was banned from traveling to the United Kingdom, and to this day I can't go there.
Well, that sheds new light on the definition of Tony Blair as being Bush's poodle.
Well, that's probably the point, is that these pharmaceutical companies, you know, these hundreds of millions of dollars in profits are being threatened, and they can get together with people in government, whether it's through lobbyists here in the U.S. or whether it's just a direct meeting with the CEO and Tony Blair, which is what happened there, and they can get their way, and they can have the government act as their lackeys and do what they need to do to stop those who oppose them.
So is Huntington Life Sciences a pharmaceutical testing firm?
They're a contract testing laboratory that will test anything, including, and they frequently test things like oven cleaners and pesticides and everything else on animals. They do test some drugs as well. They have two testing facilities in the UK and one here in Trenton, New Jersey, not far from Trenton, New Jersey, which is why there's such a vociferous SHAC campaign or a campaign against them here in the United States.
They're actually making laws around interfering with so-called testing all over the country. They're calling it terrorism. I mean, by state, as I recall.
They've made laws in places like Oregon and Texas where it's actually a felony to go on to a facility that produces animals for food, for instance, say to go to a factory farm and take pictures. You know, instead of a trespassing, you know, misdemeanor trespassing charge, just by the fact that it's a animal enterprise, it automatically becomes a felony. And we've seen a number of states that have passed laws like that.
Yeah, and I've been amazed by following those laws, and really almost post 9/11, just using it, you know, using terrorism really as a rubric for going after animal rights people. It's remarkable.
Well, if you look at the definition of terrorism, terrorism talks about targeting innocent people in order to further a social cause or a religious cause or something along those lines.
Do you think the animal rights movement is growing in this country?
Absolutely. I think not only is it growing in numbers, but it's growing in the vociferousness and in the degree, the type of tactics that they're willing to embrace. And again, I think, again, the line is starting to blur between the liberation movement on animals' behalf and other liberation movements around the world. People are looking at these other liberation movements and saying, well, if we really don't think our species is superior to any other species, then why aren't we willing to use the same tactics as were used in liberating human beings around the world?
You know, at the Shaq trial, which just started a few days ago, the federal judge agreed to impanel an anonymous jury. She concluded that allegations and evidence might make some jurors squeamish about being publicly identified with the trial.
Yeah, the problem with an anonymous jury is it scares the pants off the jury before the trial even started. That's how they helped frame up Lynn Stewart. Dr. Jerry Vlasic, let me ask you one concluding question, and that is, with respect to the Shaq trial, can you tell us what's at stake and what our listeners can do to help?
Well, there are a number of rallies planned. There are a number of things going on in the New Jersey area. And if you visit the website shaqamerica.net, there's postings there, and there will be daily updates there as far as the way the trial is going and what people can do to get involved. So I'd say that the best thing they can do is to get out there and support the rights of these activists. Whether you agree with the animal rights cause or the environmental cause or not, you know, these people are setting the agenda for what all activists, social activists, are going to be coming up against here in post-constitutional America.
Thank you very much, Dr. Jerry Vlasic, for coming on Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
You want more information? Check our website. Heidi, what's that website?
Lawanddisorder.org.
Guest is Jemana Musa. She's a lawyer and staff member of Amnesty International's UN section. She's one of the people that's going to talk to us today about the Amnesty International report. People may be aware the AI or Amnesty International report caused a huge controversy out there for a number of reasons. I've read the report. It's a fantastic report, really detailed, really nails down the U.S. as a violator of basic fundamental human rights, prohibition against torture, indefinite detentions, etc. But what really got at least the right wing up, and then President Bush, Vice President Cheney, and Condoleezza Rice, was the use of the word gulag in the AI, not in the report, but I think in the comments made afterwards. But in any case, we're here really to talk about what that report says, what it means for America, and what AI really thinks of the impact and the controversy going on right now. So welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
So give us some sense of the summary of what the main conclusions of the report are.
Well, I think it's important to remember, although you wouldn't necessarily get that sense from the comments we've seen in the press, that this is actually our annual report, which covers just about every country in the world in terms of what we found in the year of 2004 and human rights violations in all these countries. So although it's been painted as some kind of single-minded attack on the U.S., it's a report that covers the world as Amnesty International always has. In particular, when it comes to the United States, this year did focus quite a bit on allegations of mistreatment of detainees in U.S. custody, either those who are acknowledged to be in custody or those who have been disappeared into custody into place, you know, parts unknown. And so that's what we've seen, you know, a lot of the ire get up about. And I think really what's happened is this sort of tunnel vision focus on the word gulag has been used to distract people from what the actual message is, which is no matter what you call it, no matter what terminology you attach to it, there's a huge body of evidence at this point of torture and ill treatment in U.S. facilities, whether it's in Guantanamo, in Afghanistan, in Iraq, or in parts unknown. There's a large body of evidence that the Secretary of Defense himself was involved in hiding some prisoners from the Red Cross and others. There is a large body of evidence that shows that it's not only, although it's been painted this way by some of the administration comments, a few people who have gone home disgruntled and are peddling the lies about the U.S., but we've seen it in FBI reports. We've seen it in government investigations. We've seen it in photos.
I think that's what's critical here, you know, because when I heard both Bush and Cheney say, well, these guys, these detainees are a bunch of liars, I happen to have interviewed a number of them and don't think they are, but putting that aside, what about the fact, as you just pointed out, that there's FBI documents out there saying, we witnessed these kinds of things at Guantanamo?
And I think that's the question that the administration is trying to avoid answering. I mean, what they've been telling us is that, well, every allegation has been investigated transparently. But what we know is that the majority of these investigations have not been independent, they have not been transparent, and large portions of them end up classified, like the Church report. We got a 21-page executive summary of a 378-page report, yet they claim to be independent and transparent. And it just simply doesn't hold water.
Now, do you recall what some of the FBI allegations were?
Oh, absolutely. We've seen allegations of putting cigarettes out in detainees' ears, lit cigarettes into detainees' ears, allegations of people being chained to the floor in a fetal position, left in extreme temperatures with music blaring and lights on. We've seen just sort of document after document where even the FBI themselves said that the information, because that's one of the defenses that we heard from, I believe it was Vice President Cheney, that they're getting good actionable intelligence from Guantanamo. One of the things that came out in the FBI emails from Guantanamo was saying not only were they concerned about any kind of FBI involvement or association with some of these interrogation techniques, but also that the intelligence that was being gathered was suspect at best when it came to all of the types of the interrogation methods they were using. And I think another important thing to remember is the intelligence community, the military community, has always known that torture has never gotten good intelligence, ever. And I think one of the clearest things that the government, again, hasn't come back to refute was the fact that a couple of the British detainees they had confessed at some point. They said they were being tortured, so they just said sure to everything. And they confessed.
Yeah, in fact, you know, those were my clients, the Tipton guys.
Yeah.
And I interviewed them in England, and they confessed to meeting Osama bin Laden, being trained in the Al-Farouq training camp. And they said, what else could we do? We were being essentially tortured, and what else could we do to get our conditions better, we thought.
Exactly. And they got released because, as you know, the British intelligence officials were able to show they actually weren't in Afghanistan at that time. And so I think what they're not actually accounting for in their wanting to attack Amnesty or call us partisan or call us whatever they want to call us, they're not addressing the fundamental facts that they're creating all these prisons outside of the law. They're trying to put themselves above the law and not have to comply with any of the international standards or treaties that the U.S. helped craft.
Now, one question I have for you. In the report, you call for application of the Pinochet principle to American officials. Now, that's, and even in my view, I mean, we've tried that at the Center for Constitutional Rights, and I want you to talk a little bit about what is the Pinochet principle and how do you want it applied?
Well, the Pinochet principle being that there are certain types of crimes that rise to the level of universal jurisdiction, meaning that that it's such an interest to society to have these things investigated and prosecuted that countries around the world can arrest the people, even if it didn't happen on their soil or they don't have a direct connection or what's known as jurisdiction.
So you basically said, or you're calling for, if the U.S. doesn't do it itself, for criminal prosecutions in other countries around the world?
Well, we call for investigations, and if prosecutions are warranted, absolutely.
You know, the one thing, Jemima, that we got out of the Schlesinger panel, which I think is great, which I'm sure you use all the time, mm-hmm. is that Appendix E that lists the approved methods that Rumsfeld mm-hmm. himself approved, which includes forcible grooming, use of uh-huh. dogs, stress positions, taking away of comfort items, e.g. religious items. That means the Koran. So you have Rumsfeld himself essentially approving the very things that you guys are accusing the government of having done, and then you have Bush and Cheney saying it's all a lie.
Well, even better, we had Rumsfeld approving things like stress positions, sleep deprivations, again, you said the use of dogs, and the fact is these are the same things that the U.S. government in their Department of State reports, their human rights reports on other countries, is citing as torture and ill-treatment in other countries.
So let me ask you this. Basically, this is a kill-the-messenger sort of situation in the United States right now, and so I guess a couple of questions for AI is, Amnesty International, what are you guys doing about it? And I know you have some kind of campaign that you may want to mention on the radio.
We're doing a number of things, but right now we are involved in a grassroots mobilization called Denounce Torture, Stop It Now. You can actually see it on our website, AIUSA.org. And it's intended to basically hold public forums, community forums, to educate the public and to get them active on this issue, because I think there's been too much complacency currently in this administration on these issues. And we've heard things like, well, the administration was voted back in, that means the issue is over, there's nothing left to discuss. And that's simply not true. What we're seeing is more and more evidence come forward through lawsuits, through organizations like yours, like the ACLU and others, who are taking the administration to court repeatedly and pressing them on these issues. This issue isn't over. And just because an administration was reelected, voters could be voting for any reason. It doesn't mean that the U.S. electorate has voted for torture.
Now, you know,
again,
it doesn't
they
work.
They can talk about gulag all they want. It doesn't change the fact that they're operating detention centers all over the world outside the rule of law.
It doesn't work in most of the world, but the problem is, and then it seems to work for a lot of people in the United States, and I don't know what you guys think about that.
Well, I'm not entirely certain that's true. I think there's been, to some extent, a lot of education that needs to be done, but when they do polling, when you look at the American public, the U.S. public, they don't agree with torture. They don't believe that people should be sent to other countries for torture. And so just, you know, we've been dealing with a lot of the masking of terminology. This is stress and duress. It's not really torture. This is very different than what's happening in other countries. And so it's really an education battle at this point.
Thank you very much, and really congratulations to Amnesty on a report that everybody ought to go to the website. You should say it once more. Look at that report. It's a real indictment of the Bush administration. It really talks about the application of the Pinochet principle and really tells you what our country is doing around the world right now. Say the website once more for us, Jemima.
It's AIUSA.org.
Well, thanks again.
Thank you.
That was Jemima Musa, a lawyer and staff member at Amnesty International. This is Law and Disorder. You can go to our website for this program or others at lawanddisorder.org. This story of what happened at Guantanamo, the story of the Koran, of what happened with the Amnesty International report, has been in the news all the time lately. The administration, really, if you look at it a certain way, has been utterly on the defensive. They've had President Bush, they've had Vice President Cheney, they've had Condoleezza Rice go out there and say, none of this happened. You can fool some of the people some of the time, but the question again in America is, can you fool all the people all the time? They tried to do it with weapons of mass destruction in the war in Iraq. Why? Why would the American people ever believe these three people again? Well, we'll see. When it comes to Guantanamo, when it comes to the war on terror, we know not just from the detainees, we now know from the FBI and others that people were tortured, people are detained indefinitely. So why would we believe them? In fact, I've been so upset by this story that I decided to do something I almost never do. I went on to Fox TV to defend Amnesty, to defend the Center for Constitutional Rights, to defend our position that what the United States is doing in the war on terror is torture, indefinite detentions, and completely illegal. Today, we're going to be able to play you some segments from those programs. I went on The O'Reilly Factor, and I went on Hannity and Combs. And it was an amazing experience. And Hannity and Combs attacked bitterly with the word gulag, gulag, gulag. How could Amnesty International call this a gulag? Do you know what a gulag is, Mr. Ratner? Let's have a listen.
Joining us now for the Center for Constitutional Rights, Michael Ratner is back with us. Michael, my favorite left winger. How are you?
I thought I was.
Good to see you, Sean. It's a toss-up between you, Alan.
How many people do we have? Do you know how many people the U.S. is holding at Guantanamo, Islamic terrorist prisoners? Do you know how many?
Well, there's 570 people there, but I would dispute that they have been told to be they are Islamic terrorist prisoners. They are
when you look
not
at the gulag, what is a gulag? What does it refer to?
A gulag basically refers to a camp that was run in the Soviet Union, a labor camp.
Between, say, the years 1930 and 1955?
And even after Stalin for some period of time. But it comes down in our society to mean a very severe prison camp.
How many were murdered in the gulags by estimates? Do you know?
I don't know the
millions,
answer, but
though.
A lot of people were murdered.
Millions were murdered. How many people do we know that were murdered in the camps that we're talking about here in Guantanamo Bay?
We don't know of anybody that I
know
that's been murdered in
person.
Guantanamo Bay. In other U.S. detention facilities, there have been people murdered. Yeah. That we know all over the world.
Yeah, but we estimate that 20 million people were murdered in Stalin's gulags.
I just want
about
to repeat,
that. Hang on a second. Okay. Here's the point. There is no comparison. Amnesty International is a radical left-wing group. For them to make such a comparison is irresponsible, and it gives propaganda excuses to Al-Qaeda, as the Wall Street Journal pointed out today. Isn't that true?
Well, let me tell you what I know about Guantanamo. I've been representing Guantanamo.
I don't want to hear about Guantanamo.
Well, but that's the only way we can compare. We've picked up people. We've held them there now for 3.5 years without any trials at all.
We didn't kill anybody, did we? Not one person, by your own admission.
They're held without any trials. What did Stalin's camps do? They picked up people without any trials and put them into camps.
Do you like FDR?
Then we have
was FDR a great president?
I don't see how that's relevant to what we're talking about with Guantanamo.
But you think FDR was a great president? Hang on. You think FDR as a liberal was a great president?
Sure. Do you want to hear the facts about Guantanamo?
You think FDR was a great president, don't you?
If you want to hear the facts about Guantanamo, I'll speak. Well, if we're not here to talk about Guantanamo, what am I doing?
But here's the problem with you liberals.
Because that's what we're here for.
You liberals love FDR. FDR was responsible for rounding up groups of people in this country, as we all know.
But a shameful period in our history.
Here's the difference. If these are enemy combatants and these guys have links to terror, we have a tradition of this country of holding them as such. Here's the problem I have. You guys can hate George W. Bush, and you do. You guys can accuse him of all sorts of atrocities, and you do. But to make a comparison to a gulag where 20 million were killed is so outrageous.
Do you want to let me finish what the attributes of the camp
you give
are?
Aid and comfort to the enemies of this country.
You want to let your listeners make a judgment about it? 3.5 years, you pick up people everywhere in the world, you give them no trials, and you hold them despite the fact
just
that many
like
of them may be
FDR.
Innocent. The second thing you want to see is those people are abused and tortured. And it's not just the detainees that say
by the
that.
Way,
it's that the FBI itself.
You believe
in terms of
FBI?
The FBI itself saw people being abused. They saw them shackled and chained
to the
floor.
What you're saying is correct.
That's
but first of all, I don't agree with the word gulag. I think they shouldn't have used that word. But if conservatives want to just take that one word as an effort to discount everything else they say, they're making a big mistake. Gulag, I think, was a misplaced word. But interestingly enough, on March 27, 2003, and you're probably aware of this, Michael, Donald Rumsfeld used Amnesty International to justify what we were doing in Iraq. And he said, if you read their reports, you know about Saddam Hussein and how he treats people. The next day he used Amnesty International to defend Saddam Hussein using chemical weapons, saying that's what AI says. So now all of a sudden, one word, they don't like Amnesty International.
I mean, people have to really understand what this country is doing in the so-called war on terror in Guantanamo. They're picking up people all over the world. They're abusing them. It's not just the detainees who've said that. It's the FBI itself who have witnessed people chained to the floor, defecating in place. You know, the Pentagon a couple of days ago admitted that the Koran had been mishandled on a number of occasions at Guantanamo, even after all the hoopla about Newsweek.
We gave them the Korans. You are giving aid and comfort to our enemies with these outrageous comparisons, and you ought to be ashamed of yourself.
You know, the aid and comfort
you
to me,
to
the aid
yourself.
And comfort is coming from the conduct of the United States government.
You ought to be ashamed of yourself with these
comparisons,
supporting these comparisons. Coming up next,
we now come to what has become a regular feature on Law and Disorder, reading hate mail to Michael Ratner. Gets a lot of it, and he especially generated a pileful after his two appearances on Fox over the weekend. Heidi, would you favor us with the first letter, please?
I'd be delighted to. The subject line is, "You traitor." Anyone who would defend those pieces of Guantanamo Bay is a traitor, and that is you! How dare you! How dare you go on national TV and defend those people? You must be living in fantasy land. You are so out of touch with reality, it is mind-boggling. Do you think anyone in our country gives a rat's ass about those pieces of shit? If you keep defending these things, you are nothing short of a traitor. Can't you grasp that these people are our enemies? If it were up to these people, not one man, woman, or child would be left alive. And you know this. If it were up to me, I would skin every one of those live on TV. And I wouldn't lose a minute's sleep over it. You need to choose where your loyalties are and go with it. You would probably find yourself living in Iran or Syria. Enjoy.
Welcome to Free Speech in America.
Well, you're known by your enemies, and Michael, you got some good ones. Will you please close out the segment with another one, Michael?
Well, this was after an interview with on the O'Reilly Factor. Subject, your interview with John Case, who was the guy interviewing me on the O'Reilly Factor. I'm glad that Donald Rumsfeld has authorized the things you mentioned to extract information from prisoners. I must say, speaking Michael, Ratner speaking, at least the guy now acknowledges that we're using torture in Guantanamo. The letter continues. Please put your ideology aside and take a look at reality. The terrorists want us dead. You and me. It's unfortunate that they have drawn this clear line, but that is reality. We have to do what is necessary to defeat them. Thank you for reassuring me that Donald Rumsfeld is working to defeat these madmen and ensure our security despite your efforts on behalf of the enemy. Now, what's really, to me, interesting about that piece of mail is he basically is saying not that we're not torturing people. He's not arguing. We're torturing people. But he's saying that's what we should be doing. And a lot of the call-ins I get, a lot of the hate mail, are people saying that's what we should be doing. We should be torturing these people. If we can save American lives by torture, let's do it.
What's wrong with that argument?
What's wrong with the argument?
Yeah.
What's wrong with that argument? There's a million things wrong with that argument. One is you get false information, so you're chasing your rat's tail, and you're not going after the real information that might help you solve it. Number two is the real problem here in America is that we are bombing and torturing people all over the world and Muslims all over the world, and no matter how much information we get from anybody by whatever means, more and more people are going to hate us and go after us. That's what's wrong at the bottom with this whole scheme. Number three is what's going to happen to American soldiers when they're picked up. They're going to try the same things we're trying on Muslim people. What we're doing by this is creating a war of the United States against the rest of the world, in this case against Muslims, and is that the world we want?
No, absolutely. The means doesn't justify the end. The means and the ends are bound up with each other, and we expect something better from this country.
So you're not a Machiavellian?
No, I can tell you what I am, but I'm not that.
When John Brown went off to war to fight on a foreign shore, his mama sure was proud of him. He stood so straight and tall in his uniform and all. His mama's face broke out to a grin. Oh, son, you look so fine. I'm glad you're a son of mine. You make me proud to know you hold a gun. Do what the captain says, lots of medals you will get. And we'll put them on the wall when you come home.
We're really excited to have our next guest here. His name is David Reynolds. He's a distinguished professor of English and American Study at Baruch College and CUNY. But most of all, and very excitingly, he is the author of a new book on John Brown, and it's making real waves in the world of history, Civil War, and what was the role and purpose of what John Brown did at Harper's Ferry. The book is called John Brown, Abolitionist, The Man Who Killed Slavery, Sparked the Civil War, and Ceded Civil Rights. Exciting to look at a new history of John Brown and one that makes sense out of what John Brown did.
David Reynolds, it's nice to have you on the show. Tell our listening audience what the subtitle of your book is, would you please?
Well, the subtitle is The Man Who Killed Slavery, Sparked the Civil War, and Ceded Civil Rights.
And in a nutshell, how did he do that?
Well, he did it by standing up. In my view, America was nuts at the time. It wasn't John Brown who was nuts. America was the crazy one. Why? Because all the laws were lined up on behalf of slavery. He was the one Northerner who took up arms against slavery, and it was his assault on Harper's Ferry, West Virginia, it was Virginia, with 21 men that polarized the nation to such a degree that war became virtually inevitable at that point, and it was the war that ended slavery. His speech before the Virginia court, it was less than 300 words, and it was completely unpremeditated. It was just an expression of his racial views and his views on slavery. That speech, Emerson called it, as great as the Gettysburg Address. Emerson
yes.
said there were two great speeches, the John Brown speech and the Gettysburg Address. We see the world today held in the grip of terrorists. They're almost non-existent in their numbers in terms of the world, the numbers of people living in the world, and yet they're determining the whole policy of the world. And John Brown was, you can call him a revolutionary or a terrorist for a good cause, and the good cause is to get rid of slavery and to restore equal rights for people of all ethnicities. And he had a plan of freeing some slaves in the area, retreating to the mountains that he knew very well because he was a surveyor. And these mountains extend very deep into the south, and spreading what today we might call terrorist cells that would then raid the plantations and create such incredible disruption, spark slave revolts and slave insurrections, that the south would say, okay, we're willing to compromise. There was nothing that the south feared more than slave rebellions, and John Brown knew that. He wanted to tickle that fear. He wanted to prompt it and to force a compromise by using guerrilla tactics from the mountains.
Yeah, that's exactly the word that comes to mind, guerrilla tactics. And I think that his calculation was that if this is successful, it'll actually save lives, given what could happen if there was a civil war between the North and the South.
Exactly,
and as it turns out, as you say in your book, that war costs more casualties than all the other wars in American history.
Yes, all other wars combined. But I think he did a favor by prompting that war, because I think the war was inevitable. It was going to come later anyway, and if it had been later, who knows? I mean, as it was, the South almost won the war twice, of course, the North eventually won the war, but it almost lost it a couple of times, and there's no guarantee the South wouldn't have won a later war, and I think there would have been a later war. So I think that John Brown, his initial plan, which was to terrorize the South out of slavery, was the best one, but then, sadly enough, the second best one was a civil war.
Yeah, exactly. Could you finish, Professor Reynolds, could you finish that point you were making about John Brown's speech just prior to being convicted and condemned and hung, his 300-word speech to the jury that day?
Yeah, it was a very eloquent speech, and Henry David Thoreau said John Brown didn't make any effect with his rifles, as it turned out. He could have, but because he had a good plan, but he didn't. He made an effect with his words. Because his words were disseminated throughout America and throughout the world, mainly by people who hated him, because the pro-slavery reporters, who were the main people who had access to him, of course reprinted his words, because of course they knew he was totally nuts, and everything he was saying about equality between whites and blacks was the silliest thing that was ever said. So of course they would reprint his words, ha-ha. But what really happened is a few people in the North, like Thoreau and like Emerson, said, no, wait a second. This guy is not nuts. This guy, in fact, they put him on the level of Jesus Christ. And when Emerson put him on the level of Jesus Christ, then the world started listening and paying attention.
Let me ask, when you said that after 1876 and Reconstruction, I guess there was a change throughout the country, even in the North, about the role of John Brown.
Yeah.
What happened exactly then? I mean, what caused it? What were the politics of it?
Yeah, in the early 1880s, just after the collapse of Reconstruction, that was the beginning of the rise of Ku Klux Klan, extensive discrimination, lynching of blacks, almost a return of slavery, really. Not quite as bad as that, but almost. And some historians started emphasizing only his violent side, only his violent and intensely religious side, fanatical side, to the exclusion of his racial vision.
I just wanted to thank Professor Reynolds. He's a distinguished professor here at CUNY Graduate School and Baruch College. He's written just a great book on John Brown. It's just come out. Knopf published it.
David, I have to say you've written an utterly remarkable book by David Reynolds. It's John Brown, Abolitionist, The Man Who Killed Slavery, Sparked the Civil War, and ceded the civil rights.
And thanks to David S. Reynolds, John Brown's Truth Goes Marching On. Thank you.
David, this was really an honor. Thank you very much.
It was an honor to be here. Thank you very, very much.
This week's editorial comes to you from our own Michael Ratner, who, as an attorney, litigated against Mark Felt, the number two man at the FBI, who's now come out at age 91 as Deep Throat. This is no hero.
I can't believe what I've been reading lately. All of a sudden, Mark Felt comes out as the Deep Throat who's feeding Woodward and Bernstein the stuff about Tricky Dick Nixon and ultimately leading to the impeachment and the resignation of Nixon. All of a sudden, this guy, Mark Felt, is a hero. Let's remember who Mark Felt is and was. He was second in command of the FBI under the infamous J. Edgar Hoover. You all remember COINTELPRO, Counterintelligence Procedures. That was part of the FBI that set out to destroy the Communist Party, the Black Liberation Movement, the Anti-Vietnam War Movement, the Puerto Rican Independence Movement. And what did they do? You'll all remember the infamous memo saying, we have to prevent the rise of a black messiah. It could be King. It could be Malcolm X. We have to prevent the rise of the black messiah. This is the kind of guy who basically gives America a bad, bad name.
When that old train pulled out, John's mom began to shout, telling everybody in the neighborhood, that's my son that's about to go. He's a soldier now, you know. She made well sure her neighbors understood.
Law and Disorder is produced by Jeff Brady. The ideas expressed here on Law and Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work.
And she showed them to the people from next door. And she bragged about her son with his uniform and gun in this thing she called a good old-fashioned war. Lord, good old-fashioned war. And the letters ceased to come. For a long time they did not come. They ceased to come for about 9 months or more. When a letter finally came, saying, go down and meet the train. Your sons are coming home from the war. She smiled and went right down. She looked up and all around. But she did not see her soldier son in sight. But as all the people passed, she saw her son at last. When she did, she could hardly believe her eyes. Oh, his face was all shot up, and his hand was all blown off, as he wore a metal brace round his waist. He whispered kind of slow, in a voice she did not know, while she could not even recognize his face. Lord, recognize his face. Tell me, my darling son, tell me what they've done. How is it that you come to be this way? As he tried his best to talk, but his mouth could hardly move, and his mother had to turn her face away. Don't you remember, Ma, when I went off to war, you thought it was the best thing I could do. I was on the battleground. You were home acting proud. Thank God you wasn't standing in my shoes. Cause I thought when I was there, God, what am I doing here? I'm trying to kill somebody or die trying. But the thing that scared me most was when my enemy came so close and I saw that his face looked just like mine. Lord, Lord, just like mine. And I could not help but think, through the thunder sound and stink, that I was just a puppet in a play. And through the roaring smoke, the string had finally broke, and a cannonball blew my eyes away. As he turned away to walk, his ma was still in shock, seeing the metal brace that helped him stand. But as he turned to go, he called his mother close, and he dropped his medals down into her hand. Lord, Lord, down to her hand.